MechCast, Sunday, November 15th, 2020. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Hope you are having a wonderful day, week, whatever it might be when you're listening to this show. I'm glad to be back here with you for another one, and this should be a great episode because we are going to discuss new Macs, not just new Macs, but brand new architecture from Apple. Of course, I'm referring to Apple's One More Thing event. I have had some time over the past week to sit down, parse through all of the information that's been coming out since the event, and we'll run down that for you in this episode. We're also going to get into Big Sur and some of the announcements there. Talk a little bit about Apple TV Plus and how Apple TV shows are going. Talk a little bit about some upcoming rumors for new products, maybe early in 2020. We also got some HomePod mini reviews to talk about and hints at a few more products, again, that might be coming sometime later next year. And that'll wrap up the news for this week, and then we're going to jump into some of your feedback. I got a little follow-up on the health app weight stuff in the UK that we talked about in the last episode of the MacCast. We're going to talk about these new Macs, and should you wait or should you get one of them? Got a lot of questions from the community about, you know, when do I jump in, when should I do that? Related to that, also, upgrading to Mac OS Big Sur. Should you be doing that? And we'll talk about that a little bit. We'll get into something that happened this past week that impacted me and may have impacted you. I'm calling it the gatekeeper problem. We'll talk about what it is and how you can maybe work around it, or just more information about why it happened. And then there were some concerns when it happened over privacy and security. And we'll try to waylay any fears that you might have there. And then we'll talk about a new feature in iOS, the intercom feature, and how you can use that. So it should be a great episode. Hang in with me for just a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a second and thank a show sponsor, and that is CashFly. We love CashFly here at the MacCast because really, without them, you wouldn't be hearing this episode right now. They are the folks that make sure that you get these episodes quickly and reliably, and they do a great job for me, and they'd also like to help you out with your website and your business. And that's because when websites don't load, people lose interest. Matter of fact, for every second it takes a page to load, it costs a company about 16% in engagement. And fewer visits, of course, means fewer customers, and that's not great for anyone. But luckily, CashFly has your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it's delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. And with the recent addition of CashFly's flexible Edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities reach far beyond those of any traditional CDN. CashFly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-gen image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is tied to your revenue, and you know that it is, optimize your site's content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're using. The good people at CashFly are even going to provide a free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. Know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report and learn how CashFly's web optimization solution can help add 60 points instantly to your score. Visit mac.cashfly.com. That's mac.cashefly.com. mac.cashfly.com. And a big thank you to CashFly for their support of the show. As I was mentioning, Apple had their One More Thing event, And it definitely was one more thing, but three more products. And what I mean by that is Apple has a brand new processor. So the new thing is Apple Silicon. They announced the M1 processor. It's their first desktop-based processor based on their A-series designs, specifically the A14 design. But this really is a brand new processor specifically designed for the Mac, and it is extremely exciting. So that was the one more thing. That one more thing is now available in three new products from Apple, though. The Apple Silicon MacBook Air, the Apple Silicon 13-inch MacBook Pro, and the Apple Silicon Mac Mini. I think actually Apple's referring to these as the M1 machines. So you got the M1 MacBook Air, the M1 13-inch MacBook Pro, and the M1 Mac Mini. And it is impressive, folks. It was a great event, really fun to watch. It is up and available on Apple's website if you want to check it out, or you can get it on the Apple TV or any of your Apple devices. But let's talk a little bit about this new M1 chip. It is a 5-nanometer system on a chip design, an SoC design, so very similar to the A14 designs. It has 8 GPU cores and 8 CPU cores. I said that backwards. In my notes, it was the other way around, but you get the point. So it's got 16 total cores. On the CPU side, they're doing, again, similar things to what they do in the A-series processors. You've got 4 high-performance cores and 4 high-efficiency cores, 16 billion transistors in this processor. So they are jammed in there. Everything is all on one chip. That's what the system on a chip design means. So even RAM is built in something Apple calls their unified memory architecture. So this all goes to help performance. It all goes to help keep the processor low powered. In addition to the CPU and the GPU, you have a number of other things in there. You have the neural engine, so Apple's artificial intelligence stuff. You have the image signal processor for doing all kinds of image manipulation. You've got the secure enclave for security. You've got a high-performance storage controller that helps speed up the SSD performance. Low-power, high-efficient media encoders and decoders are in there. And Apple has built and designed their own Thunderbolt controller with support for USB 4. So this thing is an amazing piece of silicon. Apple has done a great job putting this together. It just kind of is the culmination, in my opinion, of all of their efforts in this area. They've been working on an amazing team of hardware engineers, chip developers for years, and this is really showing what they can do. Apple says that the M1 can deliver 3.5 times faster CPU performance and up to 6 times faster GPU performance over their previous generation Macs. Also, 15 times faster machine learning with that neural engine, and all of this, Apple says, while enabling battery life at up to 2 times longer than the previous generation Macs. So this is going to reap big benefits for the Mac platform. And with these 3 new Macs that they announced, they're already showing it. You've got the new MacBook Air. It has an M1 processor, up to 16 gigabytes of RAM. And remember, the RAM is now built into the processor. So we don't even just have it soldered on the board anymore. It's all part of the system on a chip. And you may look at that as an advantage or a disadvantage. It's a huge advantage to performance. Obviously, it means you're not going to be able to add RAM after the fact. You're going to have to buy the machine with the RAM you need in there. But Apple has had it that way for a while now, so we're kind of used to that. The one thing here is it is limited to 16 gigabytes, so some people feeling like that's a little bit of a step backwards, but you have to remember what tier these machines are at. These are kind of Apple's consumer-level products. 16 gigabytes is probably going to be enough for most people, and if you need more, Apple is still selling higher-end models with the Intel processors and other options. So this isn't your only choice, but this is your only choice if you want to go with the new Apple Silicon M1 architecture. So up to 16 gigabytes of RAM. The MacBook Air has a 13-inch Retina display with True Tone, and now it supports the P3 wide color gamut. So that's a new improvement for the display. Up to 2 terabytes of SSD storage. Apple says the MacBook Air will deliver up to 18 hours of video playback. So I think that's about 5 hours more battery life than the previous generation. So a nice bump up there. They've also removed the fan from the MacBook Air, so it is completely silent, fanless design. Comes with 2 Thunderbolt 3 USB 4 ports, a Magic Keyboard, Force Touch trackpad, Touch ID, Wi-Fi 6, and all of this while retaining its same previous starting price of $999 US. So I love the MacBook Air, and this new version just got a whole lot better, in my opinion. It's a great price for the kind of performance that this processor is said to be delivering. I think it's a pretty amazing value if you're looking for a consumer notebook from Apple. Now, as I said, they also have a new version of the 13-inch MacBook Pro. The interesting thing you're going to note about all three of these machines, as I mentioned earlier, is they all have exactly the same processor. So they're all very, very similar in terms of the specs. Where the differences come into play is a little more subtle, and we'll talk about that a little bit. So the 13-inch MacBook Pro M1 processor, again, up to 16 gigabytes of RAM, up to 2 terabytes of storage, 13-inch Retina display with True Tone and P3 wide color gamut, 2 Thunderbolt 3 USB 4 ports, the Magic Keyboard. The MacBook Pro, of course, does add the Touch Bar, also Force Touch trackpad, and Touch ID along with that, so similar to the MacBook Air version, Wi-Fi 6, starting at $1,300. Now, the one big difference that the Pro brings is that it does have what Apple calls an active cooling system, basically a fan. So this one, unlike the MacBook Air, still has a fan. And the reason that that makes a difference is you're going to have, even though you have the same processor, you with the MacBook Pro are going to be able to get longer, more sustained performance at maximum capacity. So whereas the MacBook Air, if it starts to reach its thermal limits, it's not going to have the fan to cool things down. So it's going to have to go into thermal throttling on the processor a little bit earlier. So that's where kind of the Pro level comes in on the MacBook Pro. We have to wait and see in real world tests when this actually kicks in. And that's the big question mark right now. So is the MacBook Air going to be able to really keep up with the MacBook Pro? And where is that threshold? Where is that drop-off? Because right now, you're looking at the same processor, the same architecture in both of these models. Then the third Mac that Apple announced, of course, is a new Mac Mini. This one surprised me a little bit. We hadn't heard about this in the rumors, although it makes a lot of sense because the developer model was a Mac Mini. So they did update the Mac Mini. Again, M1 processor, up to 16 gigabytes of RAM, up to 2 terabytes of SSD storage. In the case of the Mac Mini, you are going to get a few more ports. You still have just 2 Thunderbolt USB 4 ports, but you also get 2 USB-A ports, an HDMI 2.0 port, gigabit Ethernet, and that starts at $100 less than the previous model at $699. Now, there are a few differences with the new Mac Mini. It is only available in the silver color, and those of you who have been paying attention also probably noted that they've lost a few ports. And we'll talk about that whole 2 Thunderbolt port thing here in a second. Another thing about the MacBook models, the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro, that is a little bit disappointing is that they both still have just a 720p FaceTime camera. So Apple still has not updated the FaceTime cameras to be full HD. Keep waiting for the day when Apple is going to do that. Now, Apple claims that they can use the SIP processor, the image signal processor, or the ISP, excuse me, not SIP, the ISP on the M1 to improve the images from the FaceTime camera, adding in noise reduction, greater dynamic range, improved white balance, and using the machine learning and the neural engine to do face detection. So Apple says all of this will help improve the image. I really just wish, again, that they would up the hardware a little bit and combine that with that, and you'd have an amazing camera on these models. The other thing, a couple few other differences between some of the models, the base model MacBook Air has, so there's kind of two versions of the MacBook Air. There's a base model, and then I guess you'd call the mid-tier model or the upper model. And the main difference between the two is that the base model has, for some reason, a 7-core GPU versus an 8-core GPU. And speculation in the community is that what Apple is doing is they're using what's called a binned GPU for the lower cost model to save money. And what this is basically, it's a common practice in the processor industry where they'll say, hey, this is the spec that we're trying to hit for various models. So in this case, Apple would say 7-core. And what they would do is they would take their 8-core GPUs that maybe have one failed core that fails QA but still operates fine on 7 cores, and then that becomes the chip that is the 7-core chip that would go in the lower cost MacBook Air. So it's not defective, it's not bad, it's just sort of how the industry does this. And Intel's done it for years, it's how they get different level processors, and it's a pretty common practice. So nothing to worry about, but it just was caught a lot of people off guard when they were looking at the spec for the MacBook Air, because it's like, well, Apple said the M1 has an 8-core GPU, but this lower-end MacBook Air has a 7-core GPU. So that's what's going on there. If it worries you, you can pay the $50 more and get the 8-core GPU in the next model up. You can also, as I mentioned, still buy higher-end Intel-based MacBook Pros. So if you need those extra ports, extra functionality, you want the discrete GPUs, all that sort of stuff, you do still have that option. But one option that you no longer have with the Mac Mini is the option to upgrade the gigabit Ethernet to a 10 gigabit Ethernet. That option has been removed, and that seemed to upset a few people online, or a few people were calling that out. I have to imagine that option just wasn't a very popular option, which is why Apple chose to remove it. Now, that doesn't help, of course, if you're in an industry or you're a person who was using a Mac Mini, because they're used for all kinds of purposes, not just as desktops, but as servers in render farms, used for science and research. So there's probably some applications where folks were taking advantage of that 10 gigabit Ethernet, but probably not in a high enough volume for Apple to continue it. So that might be a little bit disappointing for some folks. I also mentioned that we would talk about the fact that all of these models only come with 2 Thunderbolt 3 ports, USB 4 ports, Thunderbolt 3 / USB 4 ports. And the common thought there as to why is that it's the built-in controllers that are on the M1, and Apple just only has a single controller built in there for doing 2 ports. So that's why that's common thread across the machines. The hope is that when Apple gets around to updating some of the other models like the iMacs and the larger MacBook Pros, like the 16-inch MacBook Pro, that they will up that in the processor and at least have support for 4 USB-C or USB 4 Thunderbolt 3 ports, and we would expect that to happen. A few other things to discuss. Another thing that was noted when folks were going through the specs was that there were no references to support for eGPUs on the M1-based Macs. That caused a little bit of concern in the community, because eGPUs is the way, especially with like a MacBook Air or the Mac Mini, where you can get a, you know, better, higher-end discrete processor. Folks who want to do gaming, or discrete GPU, rather, folks who want to do gaming often are now relying on eGPUs. As far as why it's not there, it's not really clear at this point. It may or may not be supported. Chances are that it is supported, that Apple just hasn't either written drivers or third parties don't have drivers for GPUs that are going to run on Apple Silicon. It's just a new processor. It's a new technology. So it might take a little bit of time before we get official eGPU support on M1-based Apple Silicon Macs. But I would expect that it's something that will eventually happen. As to when, it's not really clear at this point. A few other observations, my own observations about the event. It was another well-produced, well-paced event, keynote, Apple doing these in the age of COVID and social distancing, these pre-produced things. Obviously, they can't have people on campus, so we haven't had live events all this year. And so far, I've been okay with it. I think these are a lot of fun. I think they are very well done. I really like how efficient they are. There's not a lot of messing around. They get in, they get out, they make the announcements. And despite some of the maybe a little bit campy humor, it's still a lot of fun. And especially this one, I loved the stinger at the end with John Hodgman returning as PC. So if you watched the event and you didn't stick around all the way through to the end, you missed a nice little Easter egg. So make sure that you do that if you're going to watch it, or go back and just scroll to the end and check out the little bit with John Hodgman. I think it was a lot of fun. As I mentioned, all three of these machines have exactly the same CPU, the M1. And to me, that's going to be a little bit confusing, I think, for consumers. We're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show. You know, should you get one of these new M1 machines, and which one should you buy? And really, the only difference in a lot of ways between the MacBook Air and the 13-inch MacBook Pro running the M1 is really that fan and the touch bar. And it's got a $300 difference at the base level. Now, there are a few other minor differences. The display on the Pro is 100 nits brighter, so about 20% brighter. So that may be a big deal for a lot of people. It does have a slightly bigger battery and a little bit better speakers and microphones. So there are a few other enhancements. And I guess for $300, maybe that's enough. The big thing is going to be that fan. And as I mentioned earlier, we're going to have to wait and see how much of a difference that makes in sustained throughput. Until we can actually get these machines and run them through their paces in sort of real-world testing, we're not really going to know. Because so far, all we really have is benchmarks. We're starting to see some Geekbench benchmarks. And let's talk about those a little bit. Because in the keynote, another thing that Apple did was they kind of made some very, I think it's fair to say, vague comparisons to PCs. They didn't call out any specific models. They didn't get into any real benchmarks. They kind of had some vague charts, and they talked in terms of numbers like, you know, 3 times faster, this much more efficient. But they didn't get into a lot of nitty gritty. So it was a lot of marketing hype and fluff. Not that it wasn't valid, and not that we don't think they were valid statements, but it's really hard to tell what kinds of performance we're actually going to get. So again, we'll talk about this a little bit later in the show. I don't want to get into it right now. But basically, what you need to know is Anantech did a really nice article. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, sort of drilling into the evolution of the A-series processor and everything that sort of was leading up to Apple announcing Apple Silicon-based Macs. And they took a deep dive into the A14 processor, because obviously they don't have the M1s to look at right now. And their conclusion was basically that all of the claims that Apple is making about having the fastest PC CPU basically on the planet right now with the M1, they're saying those claims seem plausible. And if you read through this article, I think you, like me, will come around to understanding that this is likely true. But again, a lot of folks in the community aren't going to believe it till they actually see it. And we should be able to see it here pretty soon because these machines did go on sale last week. They are starting to ship, so expect them to start hitting this week. And no doubt there's going to be a lot of people pushing these to the limits, trying to see what they can do, trying to see if they live up to all of Apple's claims. But overall, man, exciting, exciting event. If, you know, I was in the market for a new machine right now, I would be picking up one of those MacBook Airs. Unfortunately, I am not in the market right now, but, you know, by the time you get around to maybe needing a new machine, I'm suspecting they're going to be a couple generations into the M series processor. So maybe we'll be on M2 or M3 and it's only going to get better from here. But, you know, Apple really flexing their chip prowess, let's say. And if the history of the A series processors is to be believed, this is going to be a great whole new generation of machines from Apple, and I for one am super excited about it. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. What do you think about all this? Some of you have already been emailing me. I know a lot of folks in the community are very excited. Did you buy a new M1 machine? If you did, tell us about it. And especially once you receive it, give us your first impressions. Send me some emails, some audio comments. I'd love to hear from you. Maccast@gmail.com. So the other thing that happened this week is Apple did release Big Sur, Mac OS 11. Yep, we're finally at 11 now. And if you've been looking to upgrade, the compatible machines that Big Sur will run on are a 2015 and later MacBook, 2013 or later MacBook Air, 2013 or later MacBook Pro, 2014 or later Mac Mini, 2014 or later iMacs, 2017 or later iMac Pros, and 2013 or later Mac Pros. Big Sur, you know, it's got some nice enhancements. It's got a whole new redesigned user interface, has a new notification center. Probably one of the biggest features is the new support for widgets. Also, an updated control center, brand new version of Safari, enhancements to photos, mail, and messages, among other things. You know, I think there's performance enhancements in there, obviously. So, nice little upgrade. Is it something that everybody needs to rush out and get right away? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe not. It just depends on each person. And again, we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show. But Big Sur is out now. They did kind of have some hiccups on launch day. It got a little bit overloaded. A lot of people trying to download and update to Big Sur right on day one, and Apple's servers felt the weight of that. And that also caused a little bit of a cascading problem, again, that we're going to talk about a little bit later. So what do you think about Big Sur? Are you excited about that? Did you upgrade? Let me know. Want to talk a little bit about Apple TV now. You know, and specifically Apple TV Plus. If you listen to this podcast, you know that I'm a pretty big fan of Apple TV Plus. I'm enjoying a lot of the shows and content on there, and it looks like their shows, their popularity of their shows, is actually maybe gaining a little bit of momentum. Parrot Analytics came out this past week with some new data showing the relative demand for Apple TV Plus shows versus the average series. This is all data from the U.S., so from U.S. viewership. And Apple's newer shows seem to be doing a little bit better than their launch series shows. So Apple launched the service with, I think, 8 or 9 shows. They did okay, but it was kind of a lukewarm reception. Now it's sounding like some of the newer content, some of the content that came out later, or series that came out later, are, you know, gaining in popularity. So the study looked at different series on Apple TV Plus 60 days from their premiere. So from the time they premiere through 60 days, and looked at, on average, how much more in demand were they than the average series in the U.S.? And believe it or not, Defending Jacob was the top spot, 29.5 times more in demand than the average series in the U.S. And I watched Defending Jacob. I thought it was a great show. Very, very entertaining. Some of the other shows, again, these are in that sort of second wave of Apple TV Plus shows that were proving to be popular. Truth Be Told and Servant. Unfortunately, my favorite show on Apple TV Plus, and somewhat surprisingly to me, Ted Lasso, it was like number 9 on the list, 12.8 times more in demand than the average show. But the one difference, though, is that Ted Lasso is seeing a rise in demand. So it's slowly going up as word of mouth has been spreading about how great that show is. So most of the shows 60 days from the series premiere start trailing off in terms of demand, but Ted Lasso is actually going up. So if you have not had a chance to watch Ted Lasso yet and you have an Apple TV Plus subscription, please do yourself a favor. Watch that show. I think it's absolutely fabulous. It's a lot of fun. It's a great feel-good show. And I just thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. And I've heard from many of you who have sort of echoed that sentiment. And yeah, check it out for sure. So as far as, you know, Apple TV Plus gaining a little bit of momentum now, I'm really not too surprised by it. I'm not surprised that the newer series are a little bit more in demand, mainly because I think there's just more people on the service. Obviously, when Apple launched the service, they didn't have a ton of people sign up on day one. It's been sort of a slow, steady build of viewers, of users. And in more recently, you know, Apple's been doing a lot more promoting. They've been putting out more stuff to kind of draw people into the service. As a matter of fact, Business Insider noted that the Tom Hanks film Greyhound was responsible for the biggest boost in Apple TV Plus signups this year. So a lot of people flocked to Apple TV Plus just to see that movie. And I'm sure a lot of them stayed on to check out some of the other programs that Apple has been promoting. And of course, they've been doing bundles with different partners. They are offering the free year of service with a new device purchase. So as people are purchasing new devices, they're getting access to Apple TV Plus for free. Apple extended that 1 year TV Plus subscription through February because of the whole COVID stuff. So people are either getting credits or they're getting an extension. So that's bringing a lot more eyeballs to Apple TV Plus. So naturally, their shows are going to be gaining in popularity. And I think what helps is just the overall quality of their shows. And we've talked about this a little bit. Their shows, every one of them that I've watched has been great, or at least good. I haven't had a single show where I went, you know, that was kind of a dud for me. I really didn't enjoy that. Some I enjoyed a lot more than others, and it's usually comes down just to personal taste. We've talked about this in the community. I've heard from many of you. You know, a lot of you like shows that I don't necessarily like or follow, and vice versa. And I think that speaks to some of the variety that Apple has, right? But I don't think you can look at any one of Apple's series and say it's bad or it just wasn't good. And I don't think there's any other service that I can talk about like that. You know, a lot of the other services are just going after volume. They throw a ton of things at the wall and they hope that a handful of stuff sticks. I think Apple is really focused in on that quality, and I think it's going to help them long term. I think they're starting to get some good buzz, and I think they have a very strong lineup, especially of new films in the works that are going to probably draw a lot of people to the service. And then they have new series that are coming, like the Foundation series that based on the Isaac Asimov novels. I think that's going to be a huge boom for like sci-fi fans wanting to get in there and check out Apple TV Plus. So I'm pretty excited about the future of Apple TV Plus, and I think Apple is as well. So we'll have to see how it grows. But, you know, are they ever going to be the top? Are they going to compete with like a Netflix or a Disney Plus? Very likely not, but I don't think that's what's in the cards for Apple. Maybe they'll get there, though, because we said this way back when about Apple Music, and Apple Music has gained a lot of momentum, too. It just takes a long time to build up these services. So Apple will continue to grow. And again, every time I'm looking through the news and I'm seeing kind of the stars and the people that they're working with and the quality shows that they're bringing on board, I think they have a good chance to have very, very good growth. So we'll have to wait and see. And again, as always, I'd love to hear your opinions on this. Let me know. For all you iPhone SE fans out there, if you were hoping to get a new iPhone SE update this spring, you may be a little bit disappointed, at least if you believe analyst Ming-Chi Kuo. He wrote in a new investor note this past week that he thinks it's not very likely that Apple will update the iPhone SE in the first half of 2021. The iPhone SE was released back in April, and apparently it's still selling pretty well for Apple. And Ming-Chi Kuo says that, plus the fact that Apple is still pushing their new iPhone 12 lineup, means that he doesn't think that Apple will have an update for the iPhone SE until the latter half of 2021. So he still does think there's going to be an update, just that it's probably going to be a little bit later in the year. So if you're an SE fan, you might have to wait a little bit longer, or you could just take a look at that new iPhone 12 mini. Yeah, it's a pretty appealing device, in my opinion. I think it's a nice option, but if you're not willing to wait, if you don't want to go for that, then you're probably gonna have to wait a little bit longer to get the new iPhone, or to get an updated rather iPhone SE. Ming-Chi also says that he thinks that Apple will have a couple of new products in the first half of 2021 in the form of AirPods 3 and a new mini LED iPad. We've actually been talking about that mini LED iPad for a while. It could be an updated iPad Pro. He doesn't really go into a lot of details in this latest research note, but he does give us a few details on the new updated AirPods 3. He says that the AirPods 3 will be similar in design to the AirPods Pro, with shorter stems and replacement ear tips, along with bringing improved battery life, but to save costs, it will not have the noise cancellation features of the AirPods Pro. I would imagine to save cost and also to continue to have that differentiation between the two products. So if you're looking for some updated AirPods, those might be available in the first half of 2021. The HomePod Mini has started shipping, should be arriving in consumers' hands pretty soon, but it was also in the hands of reviewers early, and we got some of the first reviews of Apple's new smaller HomePod. Everything is looking pretty positive for HomePod Mini. The general consensus seems to be that it has an amazing sound for such a small speaker. There's just a few dissenters in the tech community, but overall, a lot of folks saying these things sound amazing. And it's not really surprising, in my opinion, considering the S5 processor that Apple has in there and all of the audio tuning that Apple is doing in the software. A lot of the reviews also note how good the 360-degree sound is, so you don't have to worry about where you're positioning those in the room. Sounds like the HomePod Mini can fill a small to medium-sized room pretty well with sound. Also, if you get a second one and put them together as a stereo pair, a lot of folks saying that they sound better together, even better than just a single HomePod. You kind of get the accumulative effect that it makes the pair better than the whole. I guess how you would say that? I don't know. In other words, it's not just like twice as good, it's more than twice as good is what the reviews are kind of saying. Of course, reviewers also like the design of the HomePod Mini. A few of the complaints are the permanently attached cord. And also one complaint that I read about, and I kind of would agree with this, is the cord actually attaches with or connects with USB-C to Apple's 20-watt USB-C wall adapter, just that standard one. It's kind of a large brick and it sticks straight out from the outlet. But if you think about most folks and where they're going to be positioning their HomePod minis, it's going to be like on a desk or maybe on a shelf somewhere with the cable running down the back of the wall and probably something that's pushed right up against the wall. So it would have been nice if Apple would have considered maybe a flat style plug, something that plugged in on the side or the top rather than directly sticking out of the wall. And actually, that's a problem I even have with my HomePod, which has the standard sort of Apple, you know, plug that just goes straight into the wall. It sticks out quite a bit. So you can either, I guess, get a extension cord that has a flat against the wall plug and then plug into that or what have you. But it just makes it a little less convenient, a little more messy. And maybe Apple could sort of think about those kinds of applications. You would think normally they would, right? Normally this is the kind of thing that Apple thinks about. They just haven't really done that with the HomePod Mini. HomePod Mini, also, if you want to get AppleCare Plus for it, it's just $15 to get AppleCare Plus. And a lot of folks thinking that that might be a good idea because if something happens to your HomePod, the out-of-warranty replacement cost is $79 for a $99 product. So just $20 less to get out-of-warranty replacement. If you have AppleCare Plus, you can get that for just $30 US. So I don't know. That's a tough one on something like a HomePod Mini. I generally don't get AppleCare. I didn't get AppleCare for my HomePod. The thought of anything happening to it, especially like accidental damage wise, is slim to none, in my opinion. But hey, if you've got pets or you've got kids, maybe that's something to think about. I was kind of very excited about the HomePod Mini announcement. I wasn't, though, considering really ordering one. Till recently, I kind of changed my mind. I thought, hey, I want to hear what this thing sounds like. I want to try it out. So I went ahead and ordered one up because I didn't order right away on day one. I'm not going to have it until late November, maybe early December. But as soon as I get mine in, I will run it through its paces and compare it to my full-size HomePod, play around with it, and I'll give you my thoughts and opinions on it. I'm very curious to try out some of the handoff features, those sorts of things, and I will give you my opinion on a future episode of the MacCast once I have that. But of course, if you have received a HomePod Mini and you want to share your thoughts and impressions with us, please send your audio comments and emails to maccast@gmail.com, and we would love to hear from you. And then rounding out the news for this episode, let's talk about a couple new products that might be in the pipeline, some things that we thought we might see here in 2020, but maybe got delayed till 2021, but definitely some things that look like Apple is thinking about releasing at some point, because the latest version of iOS 14 beta sent out to developers, iOS 14.3, has some interesting icons in it. The community has done a little bit of digging and they found a couple of icons, specifically a headphone icon that doesn't look anything like any of Apple's existing products. And in fact, it looks very similar to some of the leaked images of Apple's rumored AirPods Studio over-the-ear headphones. So that seems to be an indication that maybe Apple has some new headphones in the works, and we might see those sometime early next year. There's also a set of related icons showing a backpack and a set of luggage, seemingly indicating an association to Apple's rumored item tracker, Bluetooth item trackers, the AirTags. There was also a leaked image this past week that purported to show an AirTags keychain. This is the rumored sort of leather pouch accessory that you would slide an AirTag into, and it has a little key ring on one end. It would allow you to attach it to a bag or to your luggage or specifically to your keys. So you could use AirTags to help you find your car keys if you were to lose them. In the image, the key ring is etched with the words "designed by Apple in California," along with "made in China" or "manufactured in China." Looking at it, you know, I noticed that the leather It kind of looks like Apple saddle brown leather, but it looked like the seams were glued, and I would think that Apple would have had stitched seams on it. So it could definitely be a fake out of China, just based on some of the leaked images and rumors that have been going on. So I'm not putting a lot of stock in it, other than the fact that it probably is a product that Apple would have. Is the image actually a legitimate Apple product at this point? Who really knows? But, you know, AirTags have been in the works. They've been rumored to have been delayed a few times. Also, the AirPods Studio headphones, we know those have been rumored and also been rumored to have been delayed. So these products are eventually coming. Apple obviously building things into the software to support them. When and how we'll see them and when they get announced, no one really ever knows. You know, it's up to Apple. I just applaud Apple for taking the time and not releasing the products early. You know, not pre-announcing the products, which they could have done. We know how well that did not go for the Air Power Mat. So I think Apple maybe learned their lesson on that one, and they're waiting till these things are fully consumer ready and ready to go before making any kind of announcement. But, you know, I'm kind of excited about the AirTags. I think that's going to be a very interesting product. I'm not really in the market for a set of over-the-ear headphones, but again, Apple often blows me away and I change my mind when I actually see these things. So AirPods Studio, are those in my future? I don't really know, but they could possibly be. But I know a lot of folks really prefer over-the-ear headphones. And if Apple can take some of their AirPod technology and build that into that kind of product, I think it's going to sell pretty well. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is MacPaw, makers of Clean My Mac X. Clean My Mac X is an all-in-one cleaning and optimization software for your Mac. It has a lot of powerful functionality and useful features. In fact, Clean My Mac X helps you stay aware of all of the apps that are installed on your Mac and their permissions, so you can find out which programs can access things like your camera and your microphone. One of my favorite features of Clean My Mac X is their Smart Scan feature. This allows you to examine your system for system log files and user cache files that you no longer need. You can clean those out. Smart Scan does a quick scan for malware. It can check for and run optimization tasks that help speed up your Mac. All of these things only take a couple seconds. I actually run this frequently, probably every couple weeks or so, just to keep my Mac up to date, fresh, and running smoothly. Another superpower of Clean My Mac X is its ability to handle all performance draining processes on your Mac. Its optimization feature is way more straightforward than the built-in activity monitor. So if you need to find something that's slowing down your Mac, you can use Clean My Mac X for that, and it does a great job. It gives you a lot more control over your apps and your files. You can find out what apps and programs you have on your Mac, and its uninstaller, that's another feature that I absolutely love. It does a great job of getting in there and removing not just the app, but all of its associated files, things that are deep down hidden in the preferences in the application support folder. It just does an amazing job. And here is really great news. If you're looking to upgrade to Big Sur, Clean My Mac X is compatible with Big Sur. They have their update out. It's ready and available for you. It has a new redesigned icon. They added a new Clean My Mac X widget that lets you check the available space on your Mac and see the trends of changes over time. So a lot of great stuff in Clean My Mac X. You can learn more about Clean My Mac X and download it for free at macpaw.app/maccast. That's macpaw.app/maccast to learn more about Clean My Mac X and to download it for free. And a big thank you to MacPaw for their support of the MacCast. On the last episode of the MacCast, we had a little conversation around the health app and entering your weight, specifically in the UK, where we had a listener who wanted to do his weight entries in stones and pounds, stones being a unit of measure for weight that they use in the UK. Of course, not the only one, but what I was told is a common one, or maybe becoming less common one, depending upon some of the feedback that I received. But regardless, it is a way to enter weight in the UK. And the health app seemed to only be able to support sort of one unit type at a time. So couldn't really combine stones and pounds. It was actually taking the weight as stones with a decimal value. And I guess one stone is roughly equivalent to 14 pounds. So he was having a bit of trouble because he was putting it in stones and pounds, but it was converting the pounds portion to a decimal, which was inaccurate, or wasn't really doing a decimal conversion. It was just adding that as the point value, which just threw the whole thing off. So he was asking for the community to kind of help out and maybe suggest some third-party apps. I couldn't specifically find a third-party app that supported the weight entry in stones and pounds, but I ended up writing a quick little shortcut to just do the conversion, basically allow you to enter stones and pounds and then do the conversion into the stones value as a decimal. And that seemed to work in importing into the health app. So I kind of built my own little app, was my solution for that. But we did throw it out to the community and did ask, hey, does anybody know of a third-party app that can kind of support this? And I did receive a couple of bits of feedback from the community. Two suggestions, really. MyFitnessPal, which is a great app for not only just doing weight tracking, but just general health stuff and exercise programs and those sorts of things in general. I've heard a lot of great things about that. A lot of people really like MyFitnessPal. And then somebody else wrote in and said, hey, I've been using the Withings HealthMate app. Now, I think that app links in with the Withings scales, but I'm assuming that you don't have to have the scale necessarily just to use the app. So those might be a couple that you want to check out, and I want to thank the community for sending those suggestions in. Earlier in the show, we kind of ran through Apple's new announcements for Apple Silicon-based Macs and the M1 processor, all of the new models. We talked about the specs and features and all those sorts of things, and it all sounds really, really great. But I also wanted to have a conversation with you in this episode about, is it worth upgrading or updating to a new Apple Silicon Mac now? Is it worth sort of being an early adopter? And really, if you're buying an Apple Silicon Mac, you are adopting a brand new architecture, a brand new technology. Now, of course, it's Apple, and Apple has done a good job, or we presume they've done a good job, integrating and testing these things. They've been working on them for years. And if they're bringing them to market, right, they're saying, hey, these are ready for consumers. Now, we also know, because we've been through some of these transitions before, that everything, you know, Apple does as good a job as they possibly can, but there's likely going to be some hiccups. There's going to be some bumps in the road. Things are going to happen. There's going to be some incompatibilities. There's going to be some frustrations. There's going to be all those things. So that's what I mean by sort of being an early adopter. Is it worth being an early adopter? And a lot of you have been sending me emails and questions asking exactly that. Hey, should I buy one of these new machines? And I can fully understand why, because it's pretty clear at this point that the M1 is going to be amazing. All the signs, all the indicators are pointing to huge, large improvements in performance with these machines. Not only performance, but energy efficiency, battery life. The whole experience is likely going to be better than what we have with Intel today. But I also think that there's a reason why Apple started this process with basically what is their entry-level consumer models. And you might even be going, well, what about the MacBook Pro? That's a Pro model. Yes, technically, but really in name only, because what we're talking about is we're talking about that base tier 13-inch MacBook Pro. It only has two ports. It's not the pro machine, right? It's kind of the consumer pro machine at best. So Apple really starting with their consumer models. And I think the reason they're doing that is, like I said, there's likely going to be some early issues, specifically with software compatibility, probably with some hardware compatibility and drivers and those sorts of things. And so for someone who uses their Mac professionally, if it's the thing that generates your income, that's harder to take kind of bumps and issues and problems with, right? If your machine is down, it's costing you money. On the consumer side of things, it can be frustrating. It may cost you some money, but you're probably going to be okay. You have less specialized hardware. You don't have software that you're probably relying on day in, day out, or at the very least, you can maybe find an alternative. It might be a little bit painful, but you can do it. But, you know, I think the big question comes, should you be an early adopter? I think it really comes down to your situation and your personality and how much of a risk taker maybe you are if you're gonna change this out for your pro machine. Because inevitably, some apps are just not going to be ready for Apple Silicon day one. Now, the good news is we're hearing that a lot of apps are. There's a lot of apps that have already pushed out their updates. If you've been running software update on your Mac recently, you'll see all the Big Sur updates that are coming out. There's going to be Apple Silicon updates coming out as the machines start to hit the market. And of course, Apple has some built-in technologies to kind of help smooth the process out. And some early signs are showing that even those transition layers, that software is actually functioning pretty well. But, you know, there's going to be some big apps, and we already know about one of them, Photoshop, that's not going to be native and ready on day one. Now, existing Photoshop, again, should run in that translation layer, but does everything run? Do all the plugins run? We don't know yet, and that's where the bumps are probably going to come into play. So, you know, if you're the type of person that really depends on your Mac day in, day out to get work done, and you have critical apps that you need to use, I would say you can think about getting an Apple Silicon Mac, but you may want to hold off until some others try it out first. Like, I don't think you want to be necessarily the guinea pig. And maybe I'm just being overly cautious. And certainly we can have a conversation about this in the community, but that's sort of how I feel about it. Now, again, Apple has offered up some great features in macOS Big Sur that should help ease the transition. The big one being Rosetta 2, which allows M1-based Macs to run Intel apps using a translation layer, basically. So you can run those apps and in theory, they should run fine. Historically, they run at a little less performance, usually around 75-80% performance. But that's just based on what we saw when we did the Intel transition. What's happening this time around is we're seeing some early benchmarks, and Apple has even commented on this, that some apps are actually running faster in emulation, in this translation layer on in Rosetta 2, than they do natively on Intel. Is that going to be the case for every application? Maybe not. Results may vary. But again, all of these things right now are kind of unknowns because we haven't seen these machines performing in the real world. And so that's what I'm saying about, you know, do you want to be a guinea pig? Do you want to be the person that finds out if these things work or if they don't work with specific applications? And if your answer is no, I don't want to be that person, then you might want to hold off on buying one of these new machines, as exciting as they are. Believe me, I'm super excited about them, but I'm not sure I'd be willing and ready to risk my production workflows for things like my podcast or my web development to one of these new machines quite yet. I'm going to want to wait and see you know, if all of this stuff comes together and is working very well. The other technology that's in Big Sur, of course, is universal apps. This is the ability to have native binaries for both Intel and Apple Silicon. Those are going to be a little longer in coming. So Rosetta 2 is likely going to be out of the gate. If you got one of these things day one, that's going to be the thing you're going to be falling back and relying on for most of your existing applications. Then you're going to be waiting for developers to convert over. And everything we're hearing is that some developers will convert over right away. Some apps are going to take a little bit longer to come out and to be processed. It's just going to depend on the complexity of the app, how easy it is to convert. Now, Apple says most apps are pretty easy to convert over, so we'd expect a lot of software to show up pretty quickly. But, you know, you could have one of those specialized apps that may take months or a year before it sees an update. And do you really want to be waiting around for that? Especially if it turns out the existing version has some sort of issue or doesn't run quite as well in Rosetta. And we really just don't know about that right now. So then the third technology that's in macOS Big Sur that is pretty neat is because Apple Silicon is based on the A-series processors and the ARM architecture, a lot of iOS apps are just going to run natively on the Mac. Now, of course, certain technologies, certain features may not work. Not every app is going to work out of the box. And also we're hearing that developers can actually opt out of the feature. So some developers like Google and Facebook are actively opting out of having their iOS apps run on macOS Big Sur. So if you were hoping to run, you know, say the YouTube app on your Mac, that one's out. Google's not going to bring that over, or the Maps app. So some of those. And so there may be a lot of developers that just simply opt out of having iOS apps run natively on the Mac. That one I feel is like less likely for a lot of professionals, but I guess there's some pro iOS apps that maybe you would be interested in running on your Mac, and those may or may not be available on M1 Macs from, you know, the get-go. So we're just going to have to wait and see. But like I said, early analysis of a lot of apps running on Apple Silicon under Rosetta 2 are showing, if not as good, faster performance. So I'm feeling like this transition this time around is maybe a little less risky. But I guess I'm just saying, you know, let's be a little bit careful, a little bit cautious. Let's not totally get caught up in the hype vortex unless, you're willing to assume or take on some of the risks. And I'm not trying to, dissuade anybody from getting an Apple Silicon Mac, but maybe get it as a second Mac, or again, if it's just going to be your personal machine and you're willing to work through some of these issues, great, more power to you. Go for it, because these machines are absolutely amazing. And let's talk about that performance a little bit. Performance we're seeing, we're still waiting on real-world testing, right? So we don't know, but we do have benchmarks coming out from Geekbench and other sources, and things are looking really, really good. Let's talk about some of those specs, too, that we didn't get from Apple. So Apple didn't talk about the processor clock speed. You know, what speed are these things running at? I think in Apple's mind, it should be irrelevant. It just is about performance and how well do your apps run. But it's looking like the M1 series processor is running at 3.2 gigahertz. So in case you were wondering what that number is, that's what it's looking like. As far as performance scores, Geekbench single core score looking to be about 1687, a multi-core score of 7,433. What does that mean in terms of relative performance to other Macs? Well, that single core performance score is better than any other Mac that is currently available. Yeah, these things are looking to be screamers. And this is also true for the single core score, even when running in Rosetta 2. So Geekbench is being emulated in Rosetta 2, or when it is being emulated in Rosetta 2, is pulling better single core performance scores than any other available Mac right now. Multi-core score beats out even a top-of-the-line 2.4 gigahertz Intel Core i9 2019 16-inch MacBook Pro. So these things are looking to be pretty incredible. So it's going to be very, very tempting to want to pick one of these up. Some of the GPU scores are a little bit different. Macs with discrete GPUs are showing a little bit better performance than these new M1 machines. But again, remember, Apple is starting with the consumer level products. So overall, yeah, these are very, very exciting machines. As far as upgrading, you know, my personal opinion is if it's just your consumer Mac and you're willing to do a little bit of early testing for Apple with your apps and those sorts of things, then yeah, go for it. These things are amazing. If you are running your Mac as a production machine that you rely on for getting work done day in and day out, maybe use a little bit of caution. And that's really all I'm saying. So kind of related to that, of course, is Big Sur, right? We've got a new operating system out this week as well. And I would say the same rules generally apply here. There's bound to be some bumps in the road, and we're already starting to hear about some of them with the release of a new operating system. And if you really rely on your machine for day-to-day work, you probably going to want to wait a little bit to upgrade. Let other people be the guinea pigs and try to figure out what's wrong. At the very least, if you're looking to upgrade, I would say take a pause, double check that all of the apps that are critical for your day-to-day usage of your machine, and also any hardware like printers, scanners, anything else you use with your Mac to get work done, audio interfaces if you're a podcaster, or maybe, you know, video devices, MIDI devices, whatever they might be. Double check and make sure all of that software, all of that hardware is fully compatible with macOS Big Sur, that there's updates available, that it's all ready to go before you do your upgrade. Also, of course, backup before you do the upgrade in case you need to roll back, in case you run into a problem. Make sure you have multiple backups. Validate those backups. Make sure that they're working before you upgrade. And then I think, you know, you should be fine. Again, if you're going into it with open eyes and you know what you're doing, I think you're going to be totally fine. If you just want to try it out, if you're just excited to see what macOS Big Sur looks like, maybe consider putting it on another drive or another Mac, or maybe partitioning a drive and dual booting the system for a little bit so you can test it out, play around with it, make sure that it is going to work for you rather than diving headfirst right in. But hey, if you're the type of person that just wants to dive right in and you're willing to assume any of the risks and challenges and those sorts of things, then again, I'm not here to stop you. More power to you. But personally for me, again, for my main production machine, the one that I use for recording this podcast, I'm not going to be upgrading for a while. I usually wait at least a couple weeks to make sure there aren't any big issues. I'm also going to be doing the research to make sure all of my applications work. I already know with my web development work, there's going to be some gotchas. There always is. So I'd rather dig into those, jump in eyes wide open, rather than jump in eyes wide shut and find out this stuff later when I'm trying to finish a critical project. But again, that's just my opinion. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on any of this stuff. So what do you think about the new machines? Are you buying one? Are you excited? What do you think about macOS Big Sur? Have you upgraded? Did you run into any issues? Has it gone smoothly for you? Let us know, maccast@gmail.com. So one little bump in the road with the release of Big Sur happened already, and believe it or not, it caused problems not just for folks trying to upgrade to Big Sur, but it actually also caused problems for other Mac users, folks on macOS Catalina, myself included. And I'm calling this the gatekeeper problem, or the gatekeeper incident, maybe we could call it. With the release of macOS Big Sur, a lot of people were trying to download it. It was very popular. It put a heavy load on Apple's servers, and this caused some slowdowns and even some failures. They had some outages and things like that on launch day. And for me, I hadn't forgotten that Big Sur was coming out, but I was working that day and I really didn't have time to be paying much attention. I was just trying to get some work done. And around 1 p.m. Pacific time on the day that Big Sur was released, I noticed that a lot of my applications were not launching. I would go to try and launch an application and it literally would just bounce in my dock like for forever. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. I thought there was something wrong with my Mac. I thought maybe my hard drive was failing. I tried rebooting. I tried all of the different steps and nothing was actually fixing it. My Mac was just completely unresponsive. And afterwards, I found out that I wasn't alone. I was actually talking to Dave Hamilton from the Mac Observer and the Mac Geek Gab podcast later that night. And he said, hey, did you have this problem around 1 p.m. today where your Mac started running really, really slowly? And I said, yeah, how did you know that? And it turned out that the load on Apple's server caused an issue with the gatekeeper feature that checks the validity of an application over the internet, or more specifically, checks the developer certificate. It's part of Apple's online certificate status protocol, the OCSP, that's built into every Mac. And what happens is, if you're running your Mac and you are connected to the internet, it will actually go out and try and, every time you launch an application, check the certificate, the developer certificate, to make sure it is a valid app. It's part of the security features that are built into your Mac. Now, if you're disconnected from the internet or you have no internet connection, that simply gets bypassed. And as a matter of fact, if it tries to make the call out, it's supposed to fail rather quickly if the service is not available. But what happened with the release of Big Sur is Apple's servers just slowed down. They did not actually go all the way down, so they were just being slow to respond. So that failure message wasn't coming back. And so when you were launching the app, it would just sit there and wait for that check to happen before it would launch. And that's why it had the effect of basically killing your apps. You just couldn't launch apps for the time this problem was going on. Now, Apple resolved the issue pretty quickly, I think within, you know, minutes or at least within a half an hour or so, and then everything went back to normal. But because the event happened, it got a lot of people looking into Apple's OCSP and sort of how it works and those sorts of things. And so there was a security researcher, and I only knew about this because many of you emailed me very concerned about this article that this security researcher and hacker, Jeffrey Paul, put together. I'll have a link to his post in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to read it over. But basically, he started to raise security and privacy concerns over this OCSP feature. And in the article, he was claiming that Apple was sending an bunch of information that could basically be used as personally identifiable information to help kind of track you, specifically if there were a government or a law enforcement request that, you know, basically it's exposing your location and all of the apps that you're running. So, you know, law enforcement and folks could see which apps you're launching, when and where you're launching them from, et cetera, et cetera. So he was saying the service was sending your IP address, which could be used for like crude geolocation of where you are, along with the date, time, a computer identifier, ISP information, city state information, along with an application hash that could identify the application that you were launching. And he claimed that OCSP requests were all transmitted unencrypted. So this would be open and available to anybody with a sniffer on your network to see. And apps like Little Snitch, and this was sort of how he found out about it, apps like Little Snitch normally can block these requests. But apparently in Mac OS Big Sur, the trust D daemon, this is the daemon that sort of makes these calls, makes the requests, is now in the content filter exclusions list, which means that it can't be blocked by any user-controlled firewall or VPN. And again, this is so Apple can make these sort of security requests to make sure that the app that's running on your machine is a legitimate app, that it is signed code signed by the developer. And so that caused quite a stir. It caused quite a bit of concern. I had a number of folks email me and say, hey, is this true? Is Little Snitch not able to work on Big Sur because of this? Well, Little Snitch can still work. It just can't block this one little process, is as far as I understand. I haven't had a lot of time to look into the Little Snitch thing, because the bigger concern was, are the claims that this guy Jeffrey Paul is making, are they accurate and true? Is Apple really sending this data? Is it unencrypted? Is it something that could be used to identify what apps you're launching? All that sort of stuff. And the fallout of this is some other folks looked into it, and Apple also provided some additional information. And I wanted to make sure that we kind of got the facts out there, at least as far as we understand them now. So good news is that OCSP does not send an application hash to Apple, which was one of the allegations that was in that Jeffrey Paul piece. What it actually sends is a hashed application certificate, or rather hashed application certificate information. So this is the certificate for the app developer, the app developer certificate, not the individual app. So if you have an app developer that produces multiple apps, the same signing certificate is used for all of that developer's applications. So every Microsoft application has the same hash. Every Panic application is going to have the same hash. And it's that information that's being sent for this OCSP request. And so that's number one. Second is that Apple went in and they updated the privacy protections section in their Gatekeeper support article to help kind of clarify things after this whole event happened. And so a couple of the key bullet points that you need to know from that is that the checks do not, and actually have never contained, any information about Apple users or their devices, so it doesn't have any personal information in that request. Apple also does not use the data from these checks to learn what individual users are launching or running on their devices, so they have no idea which specific applications are being launched. Apple also has stopped logging IP addresses associated with the developer ID certificate checks, and any collected IP addresses have been removed from their logs. So they are not going to log the IP addresses anymore, at least on Apple's servers. Now, one thing to point out about this, although not specifically mentioned in Apple's article, is because this data currently is sent unencrypted, even if it isn't in Apple's logs, it could potentially be in an internet service provider's logs. So there probably is a little bit of an information trail as to these requests. But again, remember, what's in there is an application hash for the developer's certificate. So take that for what it is. Some people may still be concerned about this from a security perspective. If you really are, there's some ways you can actually block these requests. You can edit your host file to point to localhost for this URL that Apple makes the call out to, and that'll basically just fail the request. So you can stop this if you really want it. I would not encourage anybody to do that, because I think the security protections that it brings in terms of your software and running valid, Apple blessed and signed software, I think is a bigger advantage than the risk. But that's just, again, my personal opinion. Now, the other thing that Apple has said in this article, or in this support article, is that they're going to be making some additional changes to beef up the security and protections of this service. They're looking into a new encrypted protocol for the developer certificate checks, so they're going to do that. They're going to add stronger protections against server failures, so that I would assume the next time that they have servers degrade in performance, it's not going to cause Mac OS to not be able to launch applications quickly or reliably. So that'll be a good thing. And they're going to add a new preference to allow users to opt out of these security protections. So if you don't want to have the OCSP checks happen, they're going to give you an option built into Mac OS to be able to disable that. So rather than having to do some sort of hack around or use some third-party app, they're going to give you that ability. So, you know, Apple trying to do the right thing and making some changes to make this process a little bit better, a little bit more transparent. And, you know, I don't know. I overall trust Apple. I think they're trying to do the right thing. I don't think there was anything malicious or bad about this. And as a matter of fact, I think they were really trying to protect users. And again, the internet and the community can kind of throw things way out of proportion. So we try to bring things back to reality here on the MacCast, at least as far as I understand it. Of course, I'm not a security professional. I don't live in this world. So if you do, and you think this is a bigger deal than what Apple is saying and sort of what we're talking about here, please share your opinion. We would love to hear from you. I'd love to hear other thoughts on this. So maccast@gmail.com is where you can send that. All right, last thing that I want to talk to you about in this episode is a new feature in iOS 14.2, something that I think is kind of pretty neat and cool, and that's Apple's Intercom feature. This is a new feature in iOS 14.2. It works with the iPhone, iPad, the HomePod, and the new HomePod Mini. Also works with Apple with watchOS 7.1 in your Apple Watch and AirPods and CarPlay. And what it allows you to do is send little instant audio messages to any devices that are participating in your little intercom network. And I think it works through HomeKit and the Home app. Basically, you set it up via the Home app, and you can send a message, a little audio message, to all of those devices or just specific devices in specific rooms or areas or zones on your home network. So the way it works is you enable it in the Home app on your iOS device. So if you open up the Home app, you go under Home Settings. That's the little house icon. You should see, if you've updated to iOS 14.2, the little Intercom section. So if you tap on Intercom, you can then choose when you want to get your messages. So the options are never, when you're at home, or always. So you can actually send these intercom messages just within your house, your home network, or you can have them sent even when you're away. And that's where things like CarPlay come into play. So like if someone was at home and sent an intercom message and you had this setting set to always, and you were in your car and you had CarPlay, the message would just automatically come on your CarPlay and you would hear that, and you can actually reply to them as well. So that's pretty cool. You can control in the settings which people have intercom access, and also you can choose which HomePods on your network are available to get intercom messages. So then once you have it set up, there's a couple different ways that you can send messages. Probably the easiest way is to use Siri. So you can trigger Siri and then say intercom, or you can say send an intercom, followed by the message you want to send, and then it will be sent off to all of the devices participating, again, in that intercom message, all the devices with the intercom option turned on. You can also send those messages to a specific room or zone, so you just add that to your Siri command, so intercom, or send an intercom to the kitchen, or send an intercom to the office, and then relay the message that you want to have sent. It's a pretty cool little new feature, and something that I think I will likely start to use and take advantage of. You can also just trigger an intercom manually from the Home app, either on your iOS device, or you can even do this from an Apple Watch. You just open the Home app and then tap the intercom icon. On the iPhone, it's in the upper right-hand corner. I think on the Apple Watch, it's actually a button that says intercom. It looks like a little wave form in the app, in the Home app. That will then automatically start recording your message, and then when you tap done, it will be sent out to all of the intercom devices. So, fun new feature. I've played around with it a little bit, and I like it. So I just wanted to cover how you set it up and how you use intercom, and hopefully you find that helpful. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen for Mac and iOS. You can get more information and details on their software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find me on Instagram, just MacCast over there. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.